Hello and welcome to Cruise Club. We've got the Needs a podcast. This is episode 27, War of the Worlds from 2005. I'm Joey Lewandowski.
And I'm Mike Manzi.
And Mike, weirdly enough, before we introduce our guest, I was saying to you yesterday when we hung out that next week's Hanks episode is That Thing You Do. And weirdly enough, these are two movies that I have podcasted about before, and they were both in the same month.
Whoa.
December 2017, we did the Watch the Throne episode of That Thing You Do, and I also did the Magic Mike's episode, the Channing Tatum podcast.
World of Worlds movie,
a movie in which Channing Tatum is not in, was uncredited, was cut out as Boy in Church, not in this movie. But here to talk about this as a Tom Cruise movie instead of as a Channing Tatum movie, which, again, it is not. We have a first-time guest to the Tom Club, but he has been on past podcasts of ours, including the aforementioned Watch the Throne. We have Jeremy Kelly. Hello, Jeremy.
Hey, how's it going? And I actually have done a Tom Cruise podcast before. Remember, I did Born on the 4th of July.
Oh, you did. I forgot about that. I was thinking we were like, this was like a special occasion. I mean, it still is.
Apologies.
But here you are again.
It's been a lot of episodes since then, Jeremy, so don't take any offense, please.
And you've got one more. You got one more to come with the Cruise Club in Ghost Protocol when we get to that in a couple of months. And then you've got one Mr. Tom Hanks movie way down the line. But thank you. And I guess, welcome back.
Good to be back, guys. Hopefully my connection will hold up this time.
Well, it's cool because you were on Keanu for The Day the Earth Stood Still. So you're almost like, you know, our alien invasion expert, almost, or
yeah, the alien invasion remake expert.
There we
yes,
go.
Yes, this is firmly in your wheelhouse, I think. Now, is this a movie, did you sign up for this because this is a movie that you really like, or is this a movie that you just want to talk about? Like, where do you fall on the War of the Worlds spectrum?
You know, it's one that I have a lot of nostalgia for. I remember it being one of the first movies that I got on DVD. I think it was a Christmas gift or something, and I've kind of gone back and forth on it. It's like when I first watched it, I mostly liked it, and then I feel like there was a period where I kind of like was much more lukewarm toward it. But having watched it again, you know, it actually has a lot more merit to it than I think it's gotten a reputation of being.
Yeah, this is a movie that I was not really thrilled to have to rewatch. I think specifically because the memory of me watching it 2 years ago for Channing Tatum, like, it felt like a waste of 2 hours. Not that it's a bad movie, but watching it for a reason that does not qualify for, really. It's just like, oh, what are we doing this for? Why are we doing any of this? I think this works a lot better, obviously, as a Tom Cruise movie than as a Channing Tatum movie. I like that it's a very small, kind of intimate story. But before we go too far down the rabbit hole, the proverbial rabbit hole of describing this movie, talking about this movie, let me give a quick plot summary. If anybody does not know War of the Worlds or any of the, like, I don't know, 40 or 50 adaptations of the original H.G. Wells. H.G. Wells, Orson Welles? Orson Welles.
H.G. Wells.
H.G. Wells.
But did Orson Welles do the radio broadcast?
Yeah, that was the broadcast.
So they're both Wells related.
Yeah. And,
I never
and
put that together.
That was the famous radio version where they aired it as though they were doing an actual news broadcast, and that caused mass hysteria.
Yeah, mass hysteria. Amazing.
There is a park in New Jersey where they have, I think it was nearby the radio station that they broadcast from, but this was the park that they were saying, that Orson Welles was saying the aliens crash landed in. And so if you go there, there's like little monuments kind of around, like little signs and stuff. And when I went there last summer and I just saw an older couple just listening to the radio broadcast sitting on a bench, I was like, that's kind of cool.
Yeah.
It's just like a cool little, you know, look back in history kind
of. Yeah, I think that's why this movie's set in New Jersey, like this, because this is like a modern retelling of, I guess, the book and the radio broadcast sort of combined in a lot of ways. But it's a nice nod to the history of it and everything.
So if you do not know any of the War of the Wells, as it were, here's what the movie's about. Tom Cruise plays a father for one of the very few times, I think, in a Cruise Club movie.
Yeah.
He is father to Justin Chatwin, who I mostly know from Shameless, and Dakota Fanning. Dakota Fanning's character was voted, quote, most useless thing to have in an apocalypse by MTV.
Wow,
so
squeaky.
He is a father, ex-husband, dock worker. He can't connect with his kids, specifically his older son. You know, Dakota Fanning is this sort of precocious young child. She's talking about splinters and hummus and TiVo. And she's like, look, I know things. There's weird weather going on outside. There's like crazy cloud formations. There's lightning storms, lightning strikes. people are going nuts. There's fissures in the ground that split the Earth open. An alien craft emerges. That is something different about this from other adaptations, is that not the aliens didn't invade, they were kind of here all along. Mm-hmm. And so the lightning strikes, we will later find out, are the ships above sending pilots down to the underground to raise them up and attack from there. And there's like some kind of deep, like, well, why didn't they just kill us, you know, millions of years ago or whatever? And there's never really an answer there.
I got a big question we'll get to.
I read some kind of a theory that's, you know, they might have come like millions of years ago when the planet was much, much less populated. So they were just kind of waiting to see the planet's like fertilized, so to speak, with, you know, all the people that are there now. So now there's much more of a feast, so to speak.
And the ultimate irony there is that if they had taken the planet over millions of years ago, maybe they would have survived.
Yeah, but because, they would have adapted. You
know, who knows? But I will get to that in a little bit. So lasers start turning people to ash. This sort of becomes quickly like a 9/11 allegory. It's kind of an anti-war kind of PTSD sort of movie in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
Then the movie for a while becomes like a road trip movie where they're trying to escape and survive, and they go to the mom's house to try to find the mom. Tom Cruise makes a bunch of peanut butter sandwiches, throws them at windows. Plane crashes outside. They go away. They all get attacked because they have like basically the only working car, because it's an older car, and so, you know, the electronics haven't broken down or stopped working. Tom Cruise's son keeps wanting to leave and join the military or go off with the military and sort of fight back, and he eventually goes. We think he dies. In the end, spoiler alert, he's been with the mom. He's fine. But then Tom Cruise and Dakota Fanning bunker down with this farmer who quickly loses his mind and goes crazy after he realizes that the aliens are using human life forms to kind of terraform Earth, essentially make this more habitable for them. Tom Cruise has to, he sings Little Deuce Coupe to Dakota Fanning. He then kills the farmer. Then Dakota Fanning gets taken by one of the aliens. Tom Cruise gets himself taken, so he's with her. They blow up the ship from inside with grenades. As they're walking around, they realize that there are birds sitting on the aliens. The shields are down. Army defeats them. There's no real explanation why. Then, thankfully, in the end, Morgan Freeman's voiceover returns to say, it was microorganisms all along that made the aliens die in the end. That's kind of the movie, that aliens are here, they attack, and then because germs, question mark?
Yeah.
They cannot survive much longer, and so, you know, their shields weaken, and we're able to defeat them and sort of regain dominance over this planet. And that's the movie. That's War of the Worlds.
Good job.
Thank you so much. So, I was saying before that I think my favorite part about this movie, and it's sort of a broad statement, is that I like that it's a kind of an intimate look at a family. That it is a disaster movie, sort of to the scale, Mike, that we really, I was trying to think of like other Cruise Club movies that we've had that have like a global feel like this, and I don't know that there are really many. Yeah. Like, there are obviously battles that are gigantic and like scenes and set pieces like Far and Away and Last Samurai, but this feels global on a scale that even with him saving the world sort of in like Mission Impossible movies, to date so far in Cruise Club, we really haven't gotten to, and I kind of liked that it felt both grand but also intimate at the same time.
I agree with that totally. Like, I think, you know, if anything else, this movie is really well directed. I'm pretty tired of this movie. Like, I don't necessarily think it's bad or anything, and I'm quite like Jeremy. Like, I kind of just go back and forth on it a lot, and I think I'm on the back end of it at the moment during this watch. So I also think my favorite stuff when we get to it is like even smaller, like when we get into the basement with crazy Tim Robbins, it becomes like Cloverfield 2 or something, you know? And like, that was the sense I was getting, where that movie also was like, whoa, there's like this huge worldwide thing happening, but we're getting a microscopic view of it. I think for me, that's also when the movie works best, is when it's just like him and his daughter, or him, his daughter and his son on the road, and those kinds of moments. It's kind of strange, like, also what you're saying about Mission Impossible, like, as globe-trotting as they've been so far, the rest of the world isn't in on that, right? Like,
right.
That's the difference here, I think, is, like, everybody knows what's going on.
And we're going to get to a point in Mission Impossible where he's, like, literally disarming nuclear bombs that are going to change the course of the world forever, and, you know, specifically Fallout, right? That's going to be global in a way that this feels, but so far it's kind of he's seeming like it's smaller. I mean, it's still like huge stakes and like hugely important, but feels kind of smaller in a way that this, like, we don't really see around the world, but it feels like everyone's just like, don't you know what's going on? Like, this is changing everything forever. And I think it's kind of a cool element to that. So, Mike, would you say that is your favorite part, just sort of the overall feel of it? Or is there something about this that stands out more as your favorite part, your favorite moment?
Specifically, like, my favorite sequence. And all the time, like, it kind of just snaps me back into the movie whenever I'm watching it on TV, because it's on a lot. Or even when I remember watching it in theaters for the first time. When they get in the basement with Tim Robbins, I know that's when a lot of people kind of tune out, but that's when I really, like, perk up. That's the stuff I love that sequence with him, and when the aliens break in and we actually get to see them. All that stuff's cool, the little hide and seek they play. And then maybe, you know, it's not ended in the best way when Tom Cruise murders Tim Robbins. Like, they,
which is hilarious, just for the fact that Robbins is like 10 inches taller than Cruise and is holding a shovel, and somehow Cruise is able to kill him all by himself.
Yeah, so, I mean, they sort of, you know, they drop the ball. They don't stick the ending on that sequence, unfortunately. I think they could have, like, managed to just sort of get away, sneak away, and have the same results of being trapped in the ship in the next sequence for the next beat and stuff. But quite honestly, like, I love that quiet, tense sequence going on there in the basement. I think that's my favorite part of this movie.
Oh, we were saying about this movie being much more intimate. That's like one of the reasons I kind of appreciate the movie as a remake, because if you watch the original, it more follows the efforts of like the scientists and the military on a more global scale. But this is the movie saying that, you know, you can look at a situation like this from a lot of different angles. I think that's one thing that reason of the or the story gets retold so much in different ways.
Yeah, in the original book, it's been a while since I read it, but I believe it's like Victorian era, right? So it's like almost the steampunk era and stuff. So it's cool how this can be updated and told from different perspectives over time and stuff. And I guess there's been miniseries and all kinds of things that's expanded on it too. So this concept definitely has lots of legs, lots of alien legs.
Strangely, that there were actually three versions of War of the Worlds that all came out in this same month, June 2005.
Whoa. Really?
The one made by Asylum, which making a lot of those mockbusters around that time period. And there was, I think it was also just called H.G. Wells' War of the Worlds, but it was actually in development before this one, but it kind of got swept aside, basically.
Well, I was saying to Mike yesterday that when you look on IMDb for War of the Worlds, there is an adaptation from this year. It looks like an 8-episode miniseries that aired on Fox in October and November of this year. Set in contemporary France, this Anglo-French reimagining of H.G. Wells' classic in the style of Walking Dead, follows pockets of survivors forced to team up after an apocalyptic extraterrestrial strike. I guess it's the kind of thing where you could tell any version of this story that you want, and you have the name, brand, association, the cachet of a property that people know. Like, you hear War of the Worlds, and even if you have never seen one, I think you know alien invasion. Like, I get a sense of what this is going to be, right? And so I guess that's just why they keep repurposing it and using that name and using that general premise, because you could do another alien invasion movie that isn't this and call it whatever you want, but I guess the idea is you cash in on the name recognition. Like, people know what this is, and people might tune in just because it's another adaptation of a thing that they have liked in the past.
I think that's a really good point, and I think that's why they were able to take this angle of it, because I know I was going into the movie expecting, it's not a direct remake of like that one from like the 50s or 60s or whatever, which is really good and fun, and I love that, and all those effects are great and everything, but I definitely was expecting this to be, you know, more Independence Day, right? But we're getting Spielberg's Independence Day, and this totally is not that, like, going for that whatsoever. And I think part of why it, I don't want to say why it works or anything like that, but I think why they're able to do what they're doing with the story is because, like you said, everybody knows that this is, it's in the title, it's a worldwide thing, everybody's dealing with it, so we can take sort of a microscopic view of it if we need to, and then, you know, make other movies like Independence Day that are like these, you know, multiple threads that converge.
Now, Jeremy, what about you? What about this movie or this particular adaptation or this story do you like more than anything else? If you had to pick a favorite moment or version or scene or whatever of War of the Worlds, what would be your pick?
Well, I wouldn't say favorite moment, but just favorite aspect is probably the cinematography. You know, the use of a lot of long takes. The cinematographer I'm reading is a longtime Spielberg collaborator, Janusz Kaminski. The specific sequence that comes to mind is when they're in his ex-wife's house, and you know everything's been destroyed, and it just like pans from Cruise in the house as he walks outside, and just you see like debris and carnage and everywhere, and other specific moments when you know they're still in New Jersey and the tripods are blasting away everything. I mean, it just so much craft and so much scale that goes into these sequences. You know, that to me is still like, you know, the most impressive thing about the movie.
Yeah, there's that car shot, right? And I remember being in the theater, leaning over my friend, being like, "This, how are they doing this? Because it's not cutting, and they're going weaving in and out of the car as it's, you know, flying down the turnpike and everything."
Yeah, a little bit awkward that Tom Cruise and his son stopped their conversation just long enough for the pan to happen until it's.
And I also love the scale of this too. Like, I think there's a great sense of scale between objects, just like, and I think that comes down to effects and cinematography as well. Like, just the sense of scope of things and like in proportion to stuff, so that like when you see Tom Cruise and his family on a hillside looking down and seeing all like the tripods come up over the hill and humans look like ants, like I buy all of it. It helps buy the effect, because I think they really nailed the effects, I think, is what they did. And it adds to just like filling that screen so well. Question though about the look of this film, how do you guys feel about the nitrate dip that he did again? Like, it's got like that, those really crushed blacks, and the whites are like all silver, and there's a lot of sort of flair.
He did this on Minority Report again too, right? Like, mm-hmm. It was the same kind of thing.
Yeah.
It's a look that I didn't love when I watched it for Magic Mike's, but here I liked it a little bit more, and I think that might have just been because I was fearing it was going to be worse. You know what I mean? Like, I was like, oh, I don't like the look of this movie. Then here I was just like, oh, it's not as bad as I thought it was going to be. It's of a specific, really kind of like purpose and the way it looks. And like, I get that he's going for a thing, but it's kind of boring and dull to me.
I think it's kind of a shortcut, like to make everything feel grittier. You can't really put in the time, so you just sort of, it's a post trick maybe or something. And I don't know, I would have preferred if he like took more time and used filters and things on set. I mean, the one thing it does do is ground it in its own sort of universe, you know, nothing else aside from like Minority Report, which might be the future of this world, we don't know. Anderton could be one of Tom Cruise's grandsons, I don't know. Yeah, I think it just sort of like sets it apart in a weird way. It's not my favorite, but I think it works for this particular movie better than it did for Minority Report. I don't know why.
It's a lot more noticeable, I think, during the day scenes, especially I kind of remember when Dakota Fanning is seeing all these bodies floating down the river, and like her face looks like really shiny for some reason.
Yeah, and the water's reflections like really glimmer a lot.
It's not exactly what we're talking about now, but this movie was nominated for 3 Academy Awards, including visual effects. So, I mean, it's not the way that the movie looks, but kind of the look of the movie in a sense. You know what I mean? Like, it's like there's stuff that people are recognizing and honoring here, but visual effects, sound mixing, and sound editing, this movie was nominated for. It lost all 3 of those to King Kong. But there's like the way the movie looks and the way the movie sounds, again, not necessarily the color palette, but just sort of the visual, like the presentation of it all, was honored and was recognized.
Although I read that Roger Ebert didn't like the tripods.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Definitely redesigned. Yeah, they're not what I was expecting when they came out, but I'm kind of used to them. I really like the look of them now, but in the original film, they don't even have legs. They just sort of hover. They're like flying saucer. That's not my issue with the tripods. When we get to my least favorite thing, I think it'll all come out. But I quite like how they're realized, like the horn and when they're grabbing things. And the laser beam is great. And the sound of the beam and like the or whatever they're doing, like it's cool, sort of classic serial versions of effects and things that seamlessly sort of like integrated into this modern reality because they're just from an extraterrestrial origin. So like my mind just buys it. Like I was like, that's a great laser beam.
If you want to go deep on that, there's actually a pretty sizable amount of information on the Wikipedia for this movie about Steven Spielberg's ideas and the way that he wanted to make the tripods look. He wanted them to have like a very graceful feel. The original novel describes them as over 150 feet tall, and so he wanted to make sure that they had the scale. So if you want to really go deep into his vision and his idea and whether or not you think it worked, check out the Wikipedia for this, because there's a lot of good information there about what his vision and why they're sort of the unique and the kind of iconic look that these tripods have in this movie. So I think it's kind of a cool in that regard. But Mike, you just mentioned the things you don't like about this movie. What about this movie do you not like? What would you change? What would you remove? What's your least favorite part of War of the Worlds?
I got a major one, but I gotta touch on a couple quick ones. First up, I just gotta say, like, I just can't stand Robbie. And it's not that and you can have a son and father not getting along, but like, this is too many shortcuts and too short a time to display their relationship for me. You know, I wanted to try and focus more on like one central issue with them, but it seems like there's tons of shit, like they've got lots of baggage and there's no time to really like get into any of it. And this is Robbie related. I hate when Robbie's running away up the hill and Cruz goes to stop him and then that family tries to steal Dakota Fanning. Like, why is that part in the movie?
Yeah, like it's always meant to be like this really impactful scene, but it always just kind of felt awkward to me.
That just made me laugh, and not intentionally, you know.
That's definitely a very weird example of this movie just sort of wanting to portray people on a whole as not good. Like, when they have everybody attacking the van, like, that makes a little bit more sense, but they're also, like, so crazed that they don't even care that Dakota Fanning is, they're just, like, drive off with her. And, like, it's not that they want her, but they don't not want her. It's a couple examples of that where it's like, hey, people can be good, but people can also be really bad, but there's not really a reason to it. And I think that's a lot of, like, for better and worse, that's what this movie does, right? It's like, we're not going to say why, we're just going to show you things, and you can sort of draw your own conclusions from that, which I think works in some ways. Like, the scary thing of, like, why didn't the aliens kill us millions of years ago or whatever? Like, that's kind of cool to think about. But here, just like, well, give us a little bit of answers. Or, like, at the very end, when we're able to kill the aliens, and then it's only through the closing narration that we get the answers, it's like, is that really the most satisfying way to end the movie? Like, it doesn't feel that way.
Yeah.
I also question why they cast the hilarious Lisa Ann Walter as a friend of the family that they happen to meet as they're getting up to the ferry, and then she's gone like 5 minutes later, nothing.
Yeah, it's remarkable. Like, the only likable person, or the only quote-unquote good person in this movie seems to be Dakota Fanning, and it's like she's barely, you know, the focal point of the movie, right? Yeah. Like, it's all, you're right, I never, Ray's a dick, right? Like, it's insane, like, right off the bat, and that doesn't let up either for a really long time. So I also have like I have challenges like getting on his side too, and it's only because he's protecting Dakota Fanning that I'm like still rooting for him at times.
That's just part of the common Spielberg thing to have the not good father figure.
So my main problem with this movie, though, and things that just like, oh, it's always bothered me, is like, just why couldn't the aliens just invade from space? Like, why did they have to be buried here? Because of all those reasons we were saying before, if they had just stuck around and adapted or done any kind of research before, like, shooting lightning back down into their ships, like, they would know. That's the only way the movie for me, or the story, works, is if they come from space, because they, you know, are unprotected from our, you know, organisms and stuff like that. And, like, how would they know? They can't see it. Or, you know, they're microscopic things. Like, maybe they have different technologies in those regards. Like, I just don't buy it if they've been here all along. And it always, not ruins it for me, but it just always bothers me. And I can never really get over that. And that's, and I don't like that. You know what I'm saying? Like, I just wish that was the one thing that was changed here, is that, like, the lightning is striking because the ships are landing. And, like, we actually get to see them. And it would be a great visual of those tentacles coming down out of the sky, out of the clouds. And you're like, what the hell? Is it, like, one giant thing? And then, no, it's, like, a bunch of them landing. Or they're, like, zooming across the sky as, like, meteorites and hitting down, like, in the original and stuff. Like, that was just perfectly fine. I think it's too much of a drastic change, and I think it's done because it's a remake, and it's done just to do something different. And it's the one thing they didn't need to change that they, like, really, really changed. That changed everything for me. That's the thing I was getting to all along. So that's that the aliens were here, didn't invade from space, and for me, that kind of, like, breaks everything.
The thing you don't like is kind of the fundamental idea of the movie in its entirety.
Isn't that crazy? I mean, but that is basically it, because it doesn't work, right? Because if they came down into their ships, those ships would have been exposed. It just doesn't work for me, unfortunately. But, like, it doesn't stop me from enjoying other aspects of the film, somehow, remarkably, you know? I just don't think about it, I guess. You know, once they're there, that one scene with the reporter explaining it, I just sort of tune out. It's always bothered me. I've never been able to really get over that.
I think it makes sense. Like, I don't necessarily agree with it. Like, not that I think you're wrong. It's just like it doesn't bother me. But I also I can totally see where you're coming from. You know what I mean? Like, I understand.
Yeah. Like, I can understand people being fine with it too. You know what I'm saying? Like,
yep.
Kind of to each their own thing. And if it works for you, that's cool. Like, I'm not going to get on you about that or anything. It's just, you know, don't get on me for thinking like it's not cool and stuff. But like, there's enough other things about this, and there's other movies where I have like problems with the fundamental core of them, but I'm still enjoying what's like happening and stuff. So there's still like merit here in places, just, you know, for me, not in that particular place.
Jeremy, I guess a two-part question. Number one, what do you, I think we sort of addressed it a little bit on this episode, but like, what do you think of that element, that sort of approach to the movie, number one? And if you do like that, is there something else about this movie? Like, what do you not like? Like, what's your least favorite part of War of the Worlds?
I don't mind the way the aliens come to Earth, because, you know, I think it's more of a surprise factor, because, you know, if something comes down from the sky, you're probably going to see it. If it comes up from the ground, like, but by the time you even know what's going on, you're already under attack. I just wish that, you know, they went with a different design for the actual aliens instead of H.R. Geiger mock that always seems to get used.
They do look like the aliens a little that are inside the big suits in Independence Day. Does look like a couple reused models there. So is that your least favorite part, like the actual design of the alien themselves?
Sorry to say, Mike, I think my least favorite part might actually be, you know, just when they get to the Tim Robbins house. I mean,
I love this. I love it that, you know, we could have such different, yeah, like, opinions about the parts that we like. It's so
and
good.
I agree with Jeremy too. I think that and I'll let you give your idea, but like, it just, the movie kind of grinds to a halt for me when we get there.
Yeah, that's sort of how I feel. Like the movie up until now has, you know, had so much weight and so much momentum that then we get to this house and, you know, there's very little happening, which you could say, you know, that this is where it gets suspenseful, but it's just not very interesting.
That's totally fair. Like, I can understand that. I think, I guess for me, why I liked it is because I was able to take a breath for a minute, that I was just, you know, there was a bombardment going on for like almost an hour. And so it turns into a different movie, that's for sure. And I could understand people not wanting to slow down like this much, at least.
Yeah, I think the movie in general is a little too long. They probably could have cut maybe 10 to 15 minutes off.
Like, it could have been interesting if they meet back up with that lady you mentioned, their friend, a family friend, and that they found the farmhouse together or something and it was abandoned. And
it was.
You know, there's a way to do that sequence better, I guess. It's just, I was glad it was there at all.
Yeah, I think you're right. I don't mind the concept itself, but I just so wish I would have found it more engaging.
Crazy Tim Robbins. He turns it up too much. I mean, he's in a whole other dimension here.
I could imagine him being like an alternate universe of Andy Dufresne escaping Shawshank, and this is what happens to him.
Oh, my God.
He's essentially gone nuts.
I didn't even put that. That's funny. I didn't even put that together, that he was digging another hole out of somewhere.
Got Morgan Freeman narrating again.
Holy crap. So this is basically a sequel to Shawshank on
yes.
One level.
I love it. The movie feels, and like, whether or not you want to catch your breath, I think, Mike, because I think it is a lot, but I feel like there's such a pace to so much of the movie that we get here, and I think it's kind of they downplay the character tension a little bit because the sun goes away, and so like there's not that kind of antagonism there, and it just sort of feels like peaceful for a little bit, and then obviously that gets broken very quickly, but it just feels like, okay, we're safe for a little bit, and it's like, well, this, I know that things break bad in a hurry, but it kind of feels like, oh, like, all right, okay, so I guess this is just where we are for the foreseeable future, and I think it just feels like for so much of this, there was like a purpose, there was like a drive to where they were going and what they were doing, and then for them to just lose that in a sense, it's like, oh, okay.
I hear that. I guess for me what it was like, when we get to Mom's house, I thought this is when that would happen. Like, I thought we were going to get it earlier with the kids, and then they were going to have to sort of camp out in the basement for a few scenes, but it was like, bam, plane crash, you know, like right back into it again. And we get a couple slower, like, beats and stuff, like when they're walking and get to the train, but then the train comes by and it's on fire, you know? So there's like, I feel like he never wants you to settle anywhere or feel any kind of safety at all. Like, and when Dakota Fanning goes to the bathroom by the river and all the dead bodies come by. Like, there's just never anywhere, you know, maybe he does slow down too much here at the farmhouse to make up for all that, but he does take the time to, you know, have the go into the aliens a little bit more in this part, and that's what he uses it for. But again, he could have done that other places and other times in the movie as well. So I totally hear why you guys, like, you know, why you aren't feeling this sequence too. So
we've touched upon the actual ending, and that's another thing where I feel like that really works against the movie, because if you've watched the original, the way that it's shown that the ships are like dying, like, it's a big moment. Like, the ship is approaching a church where everyone's gathered in, and, you know, they feel like the end is here, and then, like, it just dies, and, you know, you feel this huge relief, this huge big letdown. And with this, it's just, oh, by the way, this thing, these tripods suddenly started going down. Like, it just peters out in, like, such a lame way.
Yeah, it really feels like it's like, racing to the end at that point. Because, and I think it's detriment maybe of sticking too close to the ground this entire movie. Like, maybe if we had cut away to Robbie at some point and seen part of his journey, right, and been more concerned about that, and then we could have seen more tripod activity and more army military information kind of stuff, and then when that moment comes, like, it would maybe carry more weight from Ray's perspective because we have it from another view at some point. But, like, as it is, it's like, how is he the only one noticing the shields are down? It's like crazy. It's just like the movie is just like running to the finish line.
And having Robbie appear at the very end, it felt like such a last second tack on.
I audibly groaned in the movie theater because, like, it just... I'm doing it now.
Like, like, what was kind of surprising to me a little bit is that when I was getting ready to watch this movie, I was like, oh, it's under 2 hours. Like, I think, Jeremy, that you're right. Like, I think it's a little bit long, but I feel like it rushes to an end to the point where, like, things just kind of wrap up. And you're like, wait, hold, what? I think that you have room here. Like, I was sort of picturing, and maybe it just... You know, it's not like 2005 was forever ago, but I feel like, you know, modern movies might have been like a little bit long. I don't know, but I feel like you have a little bit of room to play and make this a little bit longer. The fact that it sort of feels clipped a little bit, or that they are rushing to the end. And maybe, again, maybe it's the whole, like, this is Tom Cruise's story. This is not about the military fight. Like, it's not about, you know, Will Smith teaming up with the military to take down the alien invasion. This is just like Tom Cruise, like, an observant guy. It almost feels earnest that we don't have a real resolution, but as a movie, like, as a movie watcher or whatever, like, I want there to be that.
I also took note of how many times things seem to get repeated about the aliens. Like, how many times do they say, oh, these things were buried in the ground, oh, these things came down in the lightning. Like, they keep saying things that have already been established.
Very good point. So some trivia about this movie. So after they made Minority Report together, Steven Spielberg and Tom Cruise really wanted to work together again. They sort of sat down. They had a couple of different ideas for movies. They landed upon War of the Worlds. They're like, that's it. That's perfect. That's what we want to do. Which led to this, obviously. They wanted to have J.J. Abrams write the script, but he was too busy working on a little TV show called Lost. He was working, I think, on the pilot or something of Lost, so he couldn't actually take the time to write this. So it was brought to David Koepp, who wrote the scene, or wrote the script, and they sort of rewrote it a little bit. I think this is the final Cruise Spielberg team up. Is that right?
I think so.
Steven Spielberg was not particularly thrilled with Tom Cruise's sort of behavior and performance in terms of promoting this movie, because if you'll remember, Steven Spielberg was supposed to join Tom Cruise on the Oprah Winfrey Show to promote this movie, and he had production things or something. He had the dropouts to, like, Tom Cruise, you can do this. And then it was him, I'm in love with Katie Holmes, jumping up and down on the couch. So that was the thing where Steven Spielberg was supposed to be there. Again, we do not go deep into the personal lives of the actors that we're talking about, but there's something going on here in some regard. Steven Spielberg was not exactly thrilled with how Tom Cruise was sort of behaving himself and representing the movie. That did not stop this from not being, or from being, a gigantic, colossal hit. A $130 million budget, including DVD sales, made over $700 million to date. So, like, this is a wildly successful movie.
Yeah.
So jumping on the couch did not do anything to hurt, you know, this movie's financial successes, but I can also see from a director's point of view why you'd be like, hey guy, what are you doing?
You know, even though it obviously did make a lot of money, that might have impacted the critical view of the movie in a certain way.
Yeah, I think it became the story, right? No one's talking about War of the Worlds anymore. They're talking about Tom Cruise jumping up and down on Oprah's couch, you know, and, like, he just bombed all the publicity for the movie. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, you would think, no, then they were going to wonder what movie's out, but no, they didn't. I mean, and they went anyway, you know, but I could totally see where Spielberg's coming from, where he's like, I got to distance myself from that kind of thing.
Whether or not it was fair, I think it is what happened.
Yeah.
Oh, this is Steven Spielberg's third Alien film after Close Encounters and E.T., but he thought it'd be fun to make, quote, a really scary film with really scary aliens. So it is a different kind of... I mean, he's obviously familiar with Alien movies, but this is a different look. And then two other little bits of trivia that I think I mentioned, because I remember reading this, I think I mentioned these on the Magic Mike's episode, was that while filming nearby, they went to a local restaurant or diner or deli or something. They saw a jar on the counter, a picture of a girl who had been injured in a go-kart accident, and Tom Cruise tipped $5,000 cash into the jar. I don't know who carries around $5,000 cash, but...
Tom Cruise, obviously.
Apparently. The scene where the lightning strikes, he goes outside and everybody's outside in the street taking pictures of the lightning, they just had locals in New York or Boston, wherever they were filming that. We need you to be in the scene. If you want to come outside, you can take pictures of Tom Cruise. That's sort of your compensation. Like, he's going to be there. Just come outside and make it, you know, give us the scope of this. I think it's kind of a funny thing. Like, instead of taking pictures of lightning, they're really taking pictures of Lightning McQueen. Very good transition. Look at me beautifully doing that. Jeremy, we found, I don't know if you'll remember this, but we found someone on Twitter named Harperfect who said, you can replace Tom Cruise's character's name in any movie with the name Lightning McQueen and not a thing would change. So War of the Worlds. I don't even know what is his name in this movie? David?
Ray.
That's just
Ray.
A guess. Ray. So his name
was
Ray Ferrier. I wasn't even close. It doesn't matter because he's just Tom. Like in my notes, he's just Tom Cruise. You know what I mean? Like it's not.
They call him Dad. Oh no, they call him Ray. Actually, that's right.
Yeah. Well, Robbie calls him Ray
because Robbie's a rebellious child. But so we have Ray Ferrier. Jeremy, what do you think if we name him Lightning McQueen? Then okay, so here's an idea, and I don't want to bias your input, but we name him Lightning McQueen. He's a meteorologist who then is called in to explain the lightning phenomenon, and that's the entry point into the series, into the movie. Does Lightning McQueen work as a name for Tom Cruise's character in this movie?
Yeah, I think it
does.
Yes! Sweet.
Hell yeah. I think, Mike, the way we should change this now, because I think you and I wanted to be yes every time, we should change it to be a game where we have to convince the guest why it's a good idea.
I like that.
I think we just did it. You know, lightning is in this, like, literal lightning is in this movie. I mean, not literal lightning, but, you know, CGI lightning is in this movie. We need a way, we need a reason, we need a way to explain it, right? And one man, one name, one Lightning McQueen.
That lightning might be real lightning that they comped in. We don't know. It could... Lightning present, Lightning McQueen. It works for me.
The other thing we need to figure out is if Tom Hanks, Jeremy, was cast in the role of Ray Ferrier, a.k.a. Lightning McQueen, if Tom Hanks was the father here, would this movie work? Do you think that Tom Hanks could play this role? Or, if not, is there another role in this movie? This might be tricky. There's not that many other real sort of prominent heavy roles. I got one maybe in mind. Could Tom Hanks play the Tom Cruise part? Or, if not, what role do you think he could play?
I don't see him playing this specific part. I could almost see him as the Tim Robbins character.
That's what I was thinking.
I like that a lot. Yeah.
Because there's not a lot of other opportunities for, like, someone of Tom Hanks's stature, like, another role really to fit in here. Like, there's a lot of kind of, like, local guys, like, hey, I'm walking here. Hey, your car's under repair.
Hey, fix that solenoid.
You wouldn't necessarily put Tom Hanks in. I feel like the other meaty role really is that farmer. I agree with you, Jeremy. I think I would put Tom Hanks not in the Tom Cruise part, but in that Tim Robbins role.
Farmer Tom.
Anybody else have any other thoughts before we nominate this for some awards in still to be determined award ceremony name?
No, I'm pretty good. Yeah, I think it's going to be a while until I sit down to watch this movie straight through. Again, I'm good for a while.
I will be back apparently in 2 years for some other podcast, I'm sure. But Jeremy, any other thoughts about War of the Worlds?
No, I think I'm good. I mean, I would call it a good movie. Not a great one, obviously, but it is mostly entertaining.
I think it's movies like this that are good, not great, that are going to go up and down. Like, the next time I watch this, if that time ever comes, I'm going to be like, oh yeah, I like that movie, and I'm going to sort of be a little bit underwhelmed. You know what I mean? Because it's the kind of movie where it's like, if you have higher expectations, you might get quashed a little bit, but if you're expecting nothing, you might like it a little bit more. You know what I mean? It's like one of those in-between where it's like, oh, this could be, yeah, I like this movie, or, oh, I thought I liked this movie, but I actually don't like this movie. Like, it's, I feel like it's that kind of exact threshold where it could go either way.
I had that same reaction with Elm Street 4 all the time.
Ooh, all right. Oh, actually, so another question we have, does Tom Cruise run in this movie? And I think the answer is absolutely all over the place.
Hell yeah. Yeah, he runs everywhere.
All right, so the Tom Cruise Awards, There's nothing alien related, right? Like
spaceships
don't, like, that doesn't make any sense. Best film, worst film, don't think it's, I think it's again sort of straight down the middle of the pack. Best role, worst role?
No.
No? Most badass role, I think it's kind of like what works to a certain extent, I think, is that it's kind of the opposite of a badass. Like he's kind of just like a normal guy.
Yeah, I think that's something I read one time, that it's a very a different sort of role that Tom Cruise usually plays. Like he's usually like a really confident, really successful from the outside. And in this, you know, he's just kind of a mess on both ends.
Yeah, he's freaking out like for a lot of this movie, right? Like more than his kids at some point. His kids are like, "Dad, what's going on?" And he's like, "Put the peanut butter and the batteries and the dog food, like, get it all in the car, we're going." And it's like, wait, what?
What's weird is that this almost feels like, in that description and as a father, like, it feels like a Tom Hanks role, but it doesn't, like, it's a Tom Hanks role in a Tom Cruise movie.
Yeah, that's true.
But not a role that we would put Tom Hanks in.
No, because it's like dark dad. It's not like the dad.
Dark dad.
Yeah, it's not like light dad, like Hanks is known to play. Like, if you're going to have like a bad dad, you got to get Tom Cruise to play it.
Well, just remember, Snow Dad is better than No Dad. That's from How This Get Made, about
Jack Frost?
Yep. Yeah. most daring role to take, don't think this is. Best fight, don't think that there's really a fight in here that Tom... Is there a fight that we want to nominate? I don't think so. No. Especially in terms to other movies, right?
Over the car, basically. And fights Tim Robbins, but it's off screen.
Best theme song, soundtrack, score, I'm going to say no.
The only sound I remember from this movie is the Hans Zimmer-like bloms.
The tripod noise.
The horns. Yeah. Yeah.
Best car chase, race, no, they're in a minivan for most of the movie, and that's not exactly, you know, it's not a Fast and Furious vehicle. Best dance scene, no. Best outfit, wardrobe, they're actually, the costume designer made 60 versions of his jacket as it sort of wears down as the movie goes on.
Holy crap, really?
But yeah, for like a movie that's like an hour 55 probably, for 60 versions of the jacket, like that is crazy. Special shout out to costume designer Joanna Johnston for doing that, because it's, oh boy, that's a lot of jackets.
He looked to me like Hugh Jackman Wolverine, some of the movie, because of that jacket and his jeans and everything like that. I wonder if it was just my head or whatever, but like, I was like, that's a very, like, that's a look right now. Like,
best sunglasses? No. Best death? He does not die. Best line or freak out?
I don't know about line, but he freaks out like crazy. Like, we could either do the one when he's the luckiest man on earth and not getting zapped on his way back home from the incident, or I would go with that one, really. I can't remember a bigger one. Maybe freaking out when Robbie's trying to leave.
Yeah, because he's saying, you can hate me, but I love you.
Yes, maybe that. And then he just sort of lets him go with that bewildered look on his face, like, am I doing the right thing? Is this making me a good dad?
Best sex scene, no. Most athletic feat, I don't think he has anything in this movie particularly athletic.
One moment that stuck out to me was early on when they were going inside from the lightning. He trips over the yard furniture, and I was like, oh, I bet that was like a little stunt gag that he put together himself to make things like a little more interesting in that moment.
Oh, like after we saw last movie in Collateral where he trips over the chair and they left it in?
But as far as character, most athletic feat, maybe when he gets captured and goes up the ship's anus and detonates.
It's not a character thing, though. That's the thing.
Right.
It's a Tom Cruise literally doing something that a human being should not be able to do.
Were you able to count like how long the shot of him running in the street was? Because it seemed like he might have had to do that over and over and over again, and he could have run like a good mile and a half. Like, I don't know. I'm just throwing things out there. Let me know if anything's sticking, but nothing, you know, they don't have to be in there.
I like that idea, but we also have the running scene category, and it's tricksy. I don't know.
Okay,
I don't know.
That's fine.
Best love story, worst love story, no. Best ensemble cast, I'm going to say no. Then best non-Cruise actor, male or female, I don't think there's anybody in this movie particularly that stands out. Is there or is there?
If you want to count Dakota Fanning, but this is far from her best performance.
Yeah, I agree. I liked her more as Squeaky this year in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
So I think we only have the one nominee, the You Can Hate Me, But I Love You freakout. So,
wow.
You know, it got its recognition. But again, I think it's just like a down-the-middle solid movie. It's not, you know, particularly good or particularly bad. I think it's just a perfectly adequate piece of entertainment,
which happens.
Is okay. That's not, there's worse things to have.
Yeah, it could be, you know, unwatchable, like I'm sure that Asylum version is, right? And H.G. Wells' World of the War or something.
Or it could be the remake of The Day the Earth Stood Still.
Yeah.
Well, the next movie that we're doing for this very fine podcast is we are ramping up the action to great heights in Mission Impossible 3. It's been a little while since we had a Mission Impossible movie. We're talking about, you know, global events saving the world. It's time once again to return to Ethan Hunt, get him to do his thing all over again. But Jeremy, thank you so much for joining us. And speaking of Mission Impossible, I said you'll be back on a later Mission Impossible movie down the road, but thank you for joining us today for War of the Worlds.
Glad I could be here.
We loved having you. But for all things Cruise Club, you can go to cageclub.me, facebook.com/cageclub, or at cageclubpod on Twitter and Instagram. Email us, run, at cageclub.me. Come back next week on our Hanks for the Memories feed for That Thing You Do. Come back in 2 weeks for Mission Impossible 3 right here on Cruise Club. Go check out our brand new episodes of Watch the Throne about Bombshell, our new Viva Pod Vegas about Jailhouse Rock, and all 26 shows at cageclub.me/shows. I'm Joey Lewandowski.
And I'm Mike Manzi.
And that was Jeremy Kelly. And we'll see you in 2 weeks for Mission Impossible 3 right here on Cruise Club.
I'm not bragging, babe, so don't put me down. 'Cause I got the fastest set of wheels in town. Something comes up to me, they don't even try. So I had a set of wings, man, you know she could fly. She's my little deuce coupe. You don't know what I got.